You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Hit, swing, duck.
Come get me, suck. I'm dancing. I'm dancing.
He just hit me. He hit me hard.
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, we look at Hollywood's history of the sweet science.
I still think I can knock that Marlowe on his ear in two rounds.
Boxing has a kind of raw, primitive, bloodlust drama.
And a group of artists bring Muhammad Ali's life to the stage.
Ali's ring was everywhere, the world. He was always fighting something.
My guest is the writer and Golden Gloves boxer, Robert Annecy. That's all ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. When they give out the Tony Award this Sunday, America's long cultural award season finally comes to an end, right? Not quite. Monday is the absolutely final award ceremony of the season. That's when the fashion industry gives out its awards for design. I am deeply ignorant of fashion design, as I told the Council of Fashion Designers of America when they asked me to write something about the 1990s for their annual awards program. But that didn't make them withdraw the invitation, so I found myself thinking hard. Harder than I ever expected to, about the recent history of clothes. I think it was around 1996 when the decade as a decade finally coalesced in fashion and style. Bourgeois bohemianism, that funny oxymoron, became the 90s fashion design paradigm. Bobos, as the writer David Brooks named them, are the ultimate baby boomers, insisting on having their cake and eating it, as baby boomers always do. They want to be conformist nonconformists, renegade as well as respectable, enlightened but stylish. They want to stay forever young. And so we saw the perpetual recycling of clothing styles from the 1960s and 70s during the 1990s, the return of beards, the disappearance of the necktie, the appearance of belly-exposing low waistlines, a signifier of sexual laissez-faire so universal that it's practically meaningless, just like miniskirts and bralessness were in the 60s and 70s. And tattoos and piercing were the 90s version of long hair, freak flags intended mainly to upset parents and other squares. The new good taste ideal in style and in design generally in the 90s was very Bobo. Ostentatious unostentatiousness, like the deluxe austerity of Prada clothes and SUVs and the unslick but hyper-stylish films of Europe's Dogma 95 movement, all of which was fine by me, with the single exception of casual Fridays. As far as I'm concerned, people in offices should wear sharp suits and ties or jeans and polar tech, all the same or all different, whatever they or their bosses want. Let 100 collars bloom. But it's so lame to mandate one casual day a week. It's the fashion equivalent of the split-the-difference impulse that makes for bad suburbs, places that are neither serene like the actual country nor bustling like a real city. All the other 90s artifacts are still around, even ubiquitous. But I'm happy to report that the institution of casual Fridays is already fading fast. No doubt to be resuscitated in about 2006 as a nostalgic running gag on a new sitcom, That 90s Show.
And isn't it ironic? Don't you think?
This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360.
Ironic. And yeah, I really do think.
Today on Design for the Real World, design critic Philip Noble finds something transcendent about what most of us would consider an eyesore, the Bayway Oil Refinery on the edge of the New Jersey Turnpike.
You're already in turnpike mode, and you're driving along, and the exits are ticking by, and you get to exit 13, and all of a sudden it's Blade Runner.
New Jersey Turnpike, riding on a wet night, neath the refinery's glow, out where the great black rivers flow.
I feel like there's this special class of objects that sit on the side of American highways that become mysterious in a way, because you never get to focus on them, and you're always just flying by them. And in the New York City area, the kind of highway mystery that you hear people talking about the most is the Bayway Refinery in Linden, New Jersey. It stamped the rest of the New Jersey Turnpike with this image. So if you ask anyone from any part of the country, you know, tell me about the New Jersey Turnpike, they say, oh my God, you know, the fumes, the refineries, the, you know, clouds of smog and the, you know, oil slicks. And it's all because for 2 seconds you drive by this, you know, this incredible looking thing. And the refinery towers themselves are these tall tanks where gases are separated out by their density. And then they kind of rise from this very compact landscape of little pipelines that run around, and there's holding tanks off on the side, you know, hundreds of them probably. And towards the back of the refinery are these towers where they burn off the impurities. Part of its appeal is that no one, you know, apart from whatever small percentage of the public actually knows what goes on in a refinery, no one understands what this thing is doing. But what it's doing is separating oil into its component parts using something called a catalytic cracker. And apparently they have the world's largest catalytic cracker in Linden, New Jersey. It's kind of a claim to fame. The only hint that there's any kind of human presence involved is you see on a lot of the towers, those kind of safety ladders and cages, they're just tiny little things kind of spidering up the side, and that gives you a sense of the scale. And if this is only if you've slowed down to 35 miles an hour, which is illegal on the turnpike, you know, below a certain, I think you're not allowed to travel below 40 miles an hour, but if you slow down enough and start picking up the little details, then you can get a sense of this kind of the kind of giantism of the thing. Since the movie American Beauty, this idea of finding beauty in kind of everyday ugly objects has gotten a certain vogue, and it's been well established in architecture circles for years. I mean, there are architects who have secretly based their entire careers, it seems, on the you know, the forms of the Bayway Refinery, because it's so much more powerful and involving than what most architects get a chance to build in their lifetime.
Philip Noble's column, Far Corner, appears each month in Metropolis magazine. You can see pictures of the Bayway Refinery on our website at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and it's time now for this week's cover story, boxing.
I was going to rip his heart out. I'm the best ever. I'm the most brutal and vicious and most ruthless champion there's ever been. There's no one can stop me. Lynx is a conqueror. No, I'm Alexander. He's no Alexander. I'm the best ever.
That's former heavyweight champion Mike Tyson. On June 8th, Tyson will fight the current champion, Lennox Lewis, in Memphis. Tyson's brutality seems outsized even for boxing. He's chomped off an opponent's ear. He's attacked people at press conferences. He even threatened to eat Lennox Lewis's children. As beyond the pale as Tyson is, he still may make $35 million just for stepping into the ring. The fight is reigniting public furor over the sport. It's called barbaric, corrupt, a blight on our culture. But is it really so simple? Boxing has a rich cultural legacy in this country. Back when I was a kid, we even had boxing toys. I loved playing with my plastic, spring-loaded Rock'em Sock'em robots. And boxing continues to inspire painters, writers, and, of course, filmmakers. Today on Studio 360, we'll take a closer look at the creative side of the sport. And with me to talk about that is the former Golden Gloves boxer and writer Robert Annecy. He's the author of The Gloves, A Boxing Chronicle. Robert, why do you think it is that so many writers have felt compelled to take on boxing as a subject?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. For a lot of writers, boxing takes them into a world that's kind of beyond the pale, you know, the world of lowlife, criminals, thugs, bandits, and that's very attractive for writers. And also the kind of primal spectacle of the sport, seeing, you know, two magnificently trained athletes, you know, trying to kill each other.
And I guess it's this, as you're suggesting, it's this intensely kind of physical endeavor, whereas a writer sits alone in a room all day thinking.
Exactly. I mean, boxing is a way to get in touch with the body.
What do you think of serious writers writing about boxers? I think, of course, of the work of Joyce Carol Oates, but Norman Mailer and lots of people have taken their pen to chronicle boxing and what it means.
Well, the tradition is an old one. I mean, Norman Mailer's book, The Fight, is named after a British essay of the early 19th century by William Hazlitt, The Fight. And Mailer is intentionally placing himself in that tradition. And it's just amazing to me that, you know, boxing has appealed to writers for several centuries. And Hazlitt, you know, is mostly known as a chronicler of the romantic poets.
Yeah, but you don't think of Hazlitt as a boxing writer.
But he went to some fights and was just blown away by those things I've been talking about, by the culture of boxing, the people around boxing, and by the actual spectacle of the fight itself.
A.J. Liebling, who was a great writer for The New Yorker and other places in the middle of the 20th century, was a great boxing writer as well.
Yeah, Liebling wrote really well about boxing, and regularly it might have been the subject of the majority of his essays for The New Yorker. And he has a real feeling for the boxers. I think Joyce Carol Oates suggested that he can be a racist in his depiction of boxers. I really can't see it. I think he writes with the same kind of amused condescension and empathy for boxers as he does for everyone else.
Is there a Liebling piece that is one of your favorites that you could read for us?
Yeah, there's a paragraph that I like introducing an essay that he wrote in the 50s about a Nigerian boxer named Dick Tiger. In New Orleans during the winter of 1959, I saw a match between a middleweight named Henry Hank and a light heavyweight named Jess Bowdry, both colored and both pretty good. Hank, although he was outweighed by 10 pounds, won by a knockout in the 10th round. A middleweight must be an exceptionally hard hitter to win at such a disadvantage in weight. So I made it a point to be in Madison Square Garden early this year when Hank came to town to fight another middleweight, a Nigerian named Dick Tiger. This time Hank, although he hit Tiger some of his best shots, couldn't rock the other fellow at all, and the bout ended with the African chasing the American all around the ring. Hank had shown when he was being badly punished by Bowdry that he was game enough, but there are few dreams worse than the one in which you hit a man without making any impression, and in waking life the situation is even more frightening.
Over the last 30, 40 years, various writers, I think of Mailer, George Plimpton, have gone into the ring to experience boxing. You became a boxer sort of simultaneously with becoming a writer. What made you want to box?
Well, I was living in San Francisco. I was in my mid-20s. And, being young, slight man, I had a certain lack of confidence and a certain, you know, I was neurotic and high-strung and angry. And so I really wanted to take that aggression out in some way. And I was doing karate, and karate wasn't doing it for me. There wasn't enough impact. I didn't think it was teaching me how to fight. And then I walked into a gym in the Tenderloin, which was this sleazy neighborhood in San Francisco. And from the first day, I just loved it. I loved the characters, and I loved, you know, hitting.
So unlike various yuppies who go into their gym and you put on some gloves and box, you pursued it seriously. You actually entered the Golden Gloves process.
Yeah, I'd been around boxing for, you know, a number of years, and I always thought I was missing out on something. I hadn't done the gloves, and the deadline was coming up for my age when I would have to retire from amateur boxing. And I said, you know, let me give it a real shot. Let me try to figure out, how do you get good at this? I mean, it's the hardest thing I've ever done, and I couldn't understand why I couldn't get it after all these years.
Tell me about the process. When you decided to get serious and go into the gloves competition, was that an all-consuming sort of endeavor?
Yeah, to get serious about it, I was in the gym 6 days a week. I lost a ton of weight. You know, I got down to 125 pounds, which is the lightest I'd been since I was about 13. And, you know, I took a lot of beatings, did road work every night. It was just it was grueling to get in that kind of shape, but it was also very rewarding. I mean, I liked that kind of testing of myself.
How far did you get in the process?
Well, my first year, I lost a disputed fight. You know, it was like a 3-2 decision. And then last year, I made it to the semifinals.
What was the first time you either delivered or took a serious punch? Was that a kind of a singular experience where you suddenly felt, whoa, I'm not just thinking about this anymore?
Well, my first trainer, he kind of fancied himself a boxing philosopher. And before I got in the ring the first time, he said, you know, this is the test. You know, you have to be a bit of a masochist as well as a sadist to like it, because the first time most people get hit in the head, they say, what the hell am I doing here? And they run out of the ring. But a boxer, you know, he almost likes getting hit. And you know, there's a certain jolt. There's a certain thrill. It's kind of a rush. It's kind of a high getting hit.
Were you ever knocked out, or did anyone ever knock you out?
In the gym once, I got sparring a heavier fighter, a middleweight. I got knocked out, and when I came to, I couldn't remember where I lived. It had been driven out of my head. I actually went to the subway station and sat there for a while thinking, you know, what stop do I get off at? And I had no idea where my apartment was.
So you had a glimpse of what boxers after 20 years in the ring must feel when they're punch drunk.
Yeah, the more I do it, the more, you know, kind of horror I have for what happens to boxers and the more respect I have for them in terms of what it takes to be good at that game.
Presumably, unlike many boxers, you actually researched the accreted damage that's caused by getting punched in the head. What did you find?
It's kind of chilling when you read what happens to some of these older boxers. They've done, you know, autopsies on them and their brains are shrunk into 2/3 normal size from rattling around in the skull, and there's all kinds of internal damage, and there are things that can be done to limit that kind of damage. But the fact is, if you box for any length of time, there's going to be some brain effect on some level.
Is there, I mean, people talk, especially in creative writing and evocative essays about boxing, about its horrible beauty. Do you find that, or is that a cliche?
I think it's true. I think sometimes, you know, I can look at a fight and see good round, bad round, who's getting more points in this round, etc. But then sometimes that veil of my experience as a boxer is stripped away and I just see, you know, that horrible beauty of it, of just two people, you know, punishing themselves at this incredible rate. And that's what's fascinating, you know, like bullfighting, where you're as close to death as you can be.
I'm Kurt Anderson, talking today with the writer and amateur boxer, Robert Annecy. Coming up, a choreographer brings Muhammad Ali's life to the stage. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and my guest today is Robert Annecy, the author of The Gloves, and we're talking about boxing. A great boxer dances around that 20-by-20 ring, and no one has ever done that better than Muhammad Ali. The choreographer Marlies Yerby got a Tony nomination for her work on Rent, and now she's taking Ali's moves as inspiration for a new work. Brown Butterfly will bring Ali's life to the stage with a mixture of dance, music, and video. Studio 360's Steve Nelson discovered that Yerby was not at all thrilled at first to be working so intimately with such a violent sport.
Then, as I started exploring the work with some of the dancers, I started having memories of my own, and I remember Muhammad Ali being on the TV. I don't remember even who he was fighting with. All I remember is my father jumped to his knees, ran across the floor on his knees, and screamed out loud and hugged the TV when Muhammad Ali won a fight.
Marlies Yerby's dad was a career army officer who grew up on a farm in rural Louisiana. It wasn't just Ali's incredible speed or his devastating power that brought Yerby's father to his knees.
The black man's voice was very much a silent voice. And here was this very loud man.
Bad. Been chopping trees. I done something new for this fight.
And had such a sense of I-am-ness about him that it generated a sense of real pride around being black and for my father seeing a black man.
Hospitalize a brick. I'm so mean I make medicine sick.
Man, dude. Muhammad Ali was willing to say I am in the face of everything. And if that meant he lost everything, well, then he lost everything.
You said you were the people's champion?
Yes, sir.
Do you think that you're acting like a people's champion?
Yes, sir.
Maurice Yerby is trying to fuse Ali the leader with Ali the fighter, while still leaving room for each performer's I am-ness. That's part of the vision of Brown Butterfly creator and composer Craig Harris. At a workshop performance in January, three video screens loom over the performers. Images of Ali flash and mix together with live footage of the dancers. Four musicians placed on stage imply the four corners of a boxing ring, bass and keyboards in back, a pair of drummers in front. The six dancers wear loose-fitting white shirts and black pants. They shuffle and jab and leap together, land, then freeze. A trumpet player invades their formation and spars with one of the dancers. When Yerby started to study boxers on tape, their moves seemed unnatural, almost backwards.
The way that the body moved was the complete opposite of the way the dancer naturally moves, is the opposition of the body naturally swings, almost like you would when you're walking. The boxer does not cross the body naturally. It just naturally leads with that foot, same arm, same leg. And so there was something very bizarre about that that we needed to understand.
So Yerby and the dancers went to train with a professional boxer, Gail Grandchamp. She worked them on the speed bag and the heavy bag, and then she had the dancers put on headgear and mouthguards and get into the ring.
I didn't expect to have happen what had happened, but they actually really did swing and hit. On the outskirts, the dancers are yelling, you know, move, hit, swing, duck.
He just hit me. He hit me hard. And at the same moment, then I hit him back.
Dancer Melike Jones had been inside the ring before. He fought as an amateur for 6 years, starting at age 9, and he was good, undefeated in 37 fights. Then came fight number 38.
I was winning the fight, and I was playing around. I used to love Sugar Ray Leonard, and I used to play with this little move that he does when he winds up one hand and hits you with the right. I was playing with him, ego, vanity, and he clocked me once off of one stupid mistake. And I woke up in the dressing room with the smelling salt. But I saw my mom crying, and I got a chance to view the tape. And he hit me, and it looked like my neck. It looked like he broke my neck. From that point, I was like, nah, I don't want to box anymore.
Jones decided to focus on the things he really loved, art and dancing. Now 29, he says his boxing experience didn't actually help him that much with Brown Butterfly.
I was so used to boxing southpaw stance, and Ali boxes right-handed. So it didn't help. I had to relearn everything because it was a whole different... It was like going, you know, from Venus to Mars.
Ali's style was quite unusual. The basic boxing stance is low in the body. Ali never really went down low. He stayed up on his toes.
Come get me, suck. I'm dancing. I'm dancing. Follow me, son.
The Ali shuffle, that shuffle that he does in his body and how he moves around the ring as he's fighting, and that sense of he's always almost swinging forward and reaching back at the same time. So he's broken the form.
You out, sucker.
The form is what intrigues Yerby. Taking Ali's style and grafting it onto dancers who each have a different history living inside their bodies. One member of her troupe has a background in both modern and West African dance.
So when you take the basic form or the basic technique of boxing, he almost looks like a Joe Frazier. Very almost robotic for him to break down into this form because the West African is all more up here, right? So then what I want to see is how he takes this form, which does not live on him clearly and feels confining to him, and I want to see how this form may become another form.
Yerby's not punching, but her moves are aggressive, swerving, bobbing, easing back, then springing forward. Brown Butterfly is a work in progress, and in one sense, it will never really be completely finished. The musicians, the dancers, the live video artists all have room to improvise, and each one will bring his or her own experience of Muhammad Ali to the stage.
I am the greatest. I'm too much.
Ali's ring was everywhere, the world, you know. He boxed out, whether it was his mouth, his mentality, his heart. He was always fighting something.
Damn America and what America thinks.
Improvisation, innovation, breaking the form, empowering yourself with your own aesthetic. The I am-ness is the brown butterfly, which is Ali.
For Studio 360, I'm Steve Nelson.
Brown Butterfly will premiere next year at Aaron Davis Hall in New York City. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the writer and amateur boxer Robert Annecy. Robert, in the piece we just heard, the choreographer says how surprised she was to find that the basic physical posture of boxing seems very different than dancing. Do you agree with that?
Well, sure. Boxing is a martial art, so you're positioning yourself to fight, whereas dancing is expressive movement, so there's an enormous difference.
Other choreographers have seen some parallels between dancing and boxing.
It's interesting. The dancer Twyla Tharp didn't know anything about boxing, and toward the end of her career, she wanted to get back in shape and make a real run. I guess she was in her early 40s, so she went and trained with the famous boxing trainer Teddy Atlas. And she really, you know, she gained a respect from boxing through that, you know, by seeing how difficult it was and the effort you had to put into getting in that kind of condition and the grace that was demanded of boxers. When she started performing again, Teddy Atlas came to the show and, you know, threw a pair of boxing gloves on the stage during the ovation. But she said something interesting about boxing and dance that I really liked. She said, in dance, if you make a mistake, you get embarrassed. In boxing, if you make a mistake, you get killed. I don't think that there's a better way to put it than that.
In your book, you talk about your trainer, Milton, and his waltz approach to training you. Tell me about the choreography of boxing. And is it, as it looks like it might be, a sort of balance between truly choreographed moves and improvisation, which it also must be?
That's exactly what it is. There's a standard set of moves you have to learn in a way of holding yourself, and how you play those combinations of moves and the grace with which you do so are going to, you know, measure how you do. I mean, boxing, you want to be constantly moving because it's much harder to hit a moving target than someone that's standing still. But to be actually able to move, hit, and then move out again before someone hits you, it's not as easy as it sounds.
Your girlfriend is a dancer. Has talking to her about boxing and about dancing influenced the way you fight?
Very much so. She really, you know, watching me move, she really concentrated on helping me find my center, you know, find my center of balance. And what was fascinating to me is that many of the criticisms she gave me about the way I moved were the same criticisms that my trainer was giving me, just in a different language. And it was interesting to see that, you know, to understand that both of these people were students of bodies and how they moved, just in very different contexts.
Does she watch boxing differently as a function of being involved with you?
Yes, she loves it now. She had never thought about boxing before, and now she has a real appreciation for fighters and their movement. I mean, fighters are some of the most graceful athletes that there are, and she's come to recognize that.
The boxer and writer Robert Annecy is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson, and we're talking about boxing and culture. Artists' fascination with boxing is nothing new. The painter George Wesley Bellows painted scenes from boxing matches 75 and 100 years ago. Bellows' pictures don't just celebrate the sport. They depict another dimension of the boxing spectacle, the spectators and their savage interest in the fight. From WAMU in Washington, Jackie Gales Webb reports.
I've never been to a professional boxing match, and the only times I've enjoyed televised boxing matches have been when Muhammad Ali, Sugar Ray Leonard, or Mike Tyson were fighting. I like to watch Muhammad Ali because he was, well, the greatest. Sugar Ray Leonard because I met him once, And Mike Tyson, because long fights bore me and there's always a good chance he'll knock somebody out in the first round. When watching boxing on TV, I'm part of the audience, but not of it, really. The crowd on the screen is in the background of the fighters and most of the time, out of focus. In the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., there are two famous paintings of boxing matches by realist painter George Wesley Bellows. In the paintings, Club Knight and both members of this club, I experienced another dimension of boxing. In these paintings, not only do you see the struggle, the violence, and the blood of the boxers, but you also see the crowd enjoying every minute of it.
You can see that in these crowds of faces that loom out of the dark and figures that are gesturing and mouths that are open, and you can sort of get the energy of the carnival atmosphere of it.
Frank Kelly is the senior curator of American and British paintings at the National Gallery.
What you also unmistakably notice is the savagery of Bellows' depiction of boxing. Earlier artists or illustrators who depicted the scene, the subject, tended to make it more acceptable pictorially. They would show the ring and the spectators, but the boxers would often be squaring off, but they wouldn't be hitting each other. They would be, you knew what was coming next. But Bellows not only shows them hitting each other, they're both, in both cases, these two pictures, they're almost clenched together as if they're desperately hanging on.
In Bellows' masterpiece, both members of this club, the bloodied fighter is glowing in light as the dark fighter advances. I was so taken by Bellows' bold use of light and dark that I didn't notice that the dark fighter was African-American until Franklin Kelly pointed it out to me.
The fighter on the left, who is white, has blood running down his face. He seems to be buckling at the knees. The fighter on the right, who's African-American, seems to be lunging almost sort of forward with what you think may be the last blow that this particular fighter will absorb. It's viscerally horrifying, and then you see all those faces, and they go from the faces of the crowd. They go from being just sort of engaged spectators having a good time to people who are literally lusting for blood.
Both members of this club and Club Knight were among the first paintings of George Wesley Bellows' career to receive great attention and fame. Bellows had moved from Ohio to New York as a young art student and was influenced by the style of realist painting known as the Ashcan School. Ashcan artists found beauty in scenes of city life with ordinary people and commonplace settings. Bellows' studio was close to Sharkey's Athletic Club. It was a saloon that had a back room where boxing matches could be held. It was called a club because in the early 20th century, professional boxing was illegal in New York. Boxers were brought in to fight by making them a member of the club. Men could come in and have drinks, socialize, and watch two men beat each other's brains out.
Remarkably, for a subject that's so, again, so brutal and so seemingly anti-art, Bellows painted these pictures with very beautiful brushwork. They're with expressive sweeps of... He was a great handler of paint, just the sheer textures of paint. And even as you're sort of repulsed by the bloodied figure of the white man, you see these wonderful streaks of paint that define his rib cage and the greens of his trunk. It's Bellows can't help himself. You know, he's a painter.
Though the Bellows boxing paintings are frozen moments in time, the dramatic dark and light of the grimy ashcan colors, the smirking faces at ringside as they wait for the final blow from the dominant fighter, and the pain and struggle of the boxers express all the action of a violent final round. It's a different reality than what you experience while viewing a televised bout. Gazing at these paintings may lead to doubt about wanting to be a member of the club.
What's remarkable in the power of these images almost 100 years later is that they can still suggest that I just want to turn away and I don't want to deal with this. I don't want to think that I might be somebody who would sit in that smoky room and yell and grin like that as this spectacle happens that I'm paying for. You know, it's a kind of debasing of not just the men who are fighting, but all of us. And I think that's very powerful.
For Studio 360, I'm Jackie Gales-Webb.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the boxer and writer Robert Annecy. Robert, have you seen those Bellows paintings or some of them?
Yes, I have.
What do you think of them as depictions of the scene and as Jackie said, not just the fighters but the sort of savagery of the people watching this spectacle?
Well, I think Bellows said something very interesting about his boxing paintings. He said, I don't know anything about boxing. I'm just trying to represent two men trying to kill each other. And I think he really connects to that primal level of, you know, your life is at stake here in the ring and what, you know, and everything that's attached to that.
Well, and as bloody and violent as those scenes are, and you can see them on our website at studio360.org, one thinks of boxing a century before when people didn't wear gloves, and it must have been an absolutely brutal, extraordinary experience to be a boxer or in the crowd.
Yeah, boxing evolved in the 19th century. Originally, you know, you could use wrestling holds. You were fighting bare knuckle. You could grab the guy and throw him on the ground. And it's only with the introduction of the padded gloves and the ring. The seconds used to stand in the ring. So you would have someone standing next to you. They would grab your opponent's arm sometimes. That was a foul, but people would do it. And gradually, you know, boxing was bound by rules and given the form that we know today.
Bellows was painting obviously at a time when boxing figured much more centrally to American life and American culture as it did for much of the 20th century. Why do you think boxing is not as central to people's lives and imaginations as today as it was even 30 or 40 years ago?
There are a lot of reasons. Certainly, boxing was more central to American life in Bellows' day. One of the missions of those Ashcan painters was to represent, you know, real American life and the life on the streets. And boxing for every American man of that era was something you did. Everyone boxed a little. A.J. Liebling boxed, who we talked about earlier.
It was like golf, essentially.
It was like golf. The Ivy Leagues, everyone in the Ivy Leagues boxed. Hemingway boxed on the Princeton boxing team. It was just something you did if you were a man. And it was America was a frontier culture in a lot of ways. So that was part of being a man in that culture was knowing how to use your hands. Kind of the end of boxing, Liebling marks it in the 50s with the rise of television. People wouldn't go out and see club fights anymore. So that kind of knocked out the market for, you know, neighborhood fighters. I also think the suburbanization of America had a lot to do with it. Boxing has always been a very urban sport and an immigrant sport. And, you know, the majority of white Americans moved out of the cities and they kind of left boxing behind. And then the last nail in the coffin of boxing was the big martial arts explosion in the 60s and 70s, whereas kids who wanted to fight, you know, would go to a dojo instead of going to a boxing gym.
Just because it was novel and cooler and something that nobody else did at the time.
Yeah, it wasn't ghetto. You know, it had more middle class kind of connections.
But now as white middle class suburbanites are embracing all things ghetto, will there be a revival of interest in boxing, do you think?
I think there has been a revival of interest in boxing, the phenomenon of white collar boxing. It's funny going to some of these gyms, even a gym like Gleason's in Brooklyn, which is maybe the most famous boxing gym in the world, you know, and half the clientele is your traditional, you know, street kids and professional boxers and boxing people. And the other half is, you know, middle-aged white guys from, you know, who work office jobs and women, which is another new addition to the mix.
Robert Annecy is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson, and in a minute, we'll look at the cinematic history of The Sweet Science. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Competition's paying the price. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and my guest today is Robert Annecy, the author of The Gloves. We're talking about boxing. In the 1930s and 40s, everybody listened to boxing matches on the radio. You could pretty much walk down the street of a city like New York and hear an entire fight through open windows, one after another. And then there are boxing movies. Sarah Fischko tells us there have been more than 100 feature films in the sound era about fighting, boxing, and some, such as The Battling Butler, even before that.
They're coming after you. You are the heavyweight champion of the world.
I have an inexplicable affection for boxing movies.
Mr. Clay, you're under arrest.
In fact, I can honestly say everything I know about boxing I learned from the movies, cliches and all.
Story of a boy who rose from the depths of poverty to become champion of the world.
The ring is the stage.
Veteran journalist Jack Newfield can't resist a good boxing film. He's been a boxing enthusiast since his boyhood in the Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn, where some of the boys in the neighborhood grew up to be fighters.
Once I started to write for the Village Voice in 1964, every once in a while, I would write a boxing piece.
A lot of writing has been done on the subject. Nelson Algren, Camus wrote about boxing, Mailer, Bud Schulberg, Hemingway, Joyce Carol Oates. She described boxing's eerie fascination. A madness, she said, sanctioned by tradition and custom.
Boxing has a kind of raw, primitive, bloodlust drama that has always attracted writers and wonderful filmmakers.
This is the only sport in the world where two guys get paid for doing something they'd be arrested for if they got drunk and did it for nothing.
In Champion from 1949, based on a Ring Lardner story, with Kirk Douglas starring in his first major role, a greedy fighter sells his soul to be the champ.
We're in. We're on that gravy train and it's making no stops.
The champ double-crosses just about everyone.
I know it's a dirty trick on you guys, but... well, it worked out okay, didn't it?
And then dies of a brain hemorrhage. His brother's final statement is the final irony.
He was a credit to the fight game to the very end.
It was always fun to watch fighting in the movies, even the Joe Palooka movies.
Victor Novasky, publisher and editorial director of The Nation magazine, is a fight fan from way back. Sometimes he and Newfield watch the fights together.
My father went to the fights every Friday night, and my definition of being grown up was when he would take me to the fights. His favorite fighter was Benny Leonard, who wore a Jewish star on his trunks, and he would describe fighting as, quote, the manly art of self-defense, close quote.
In fact, in the 50s, there was even a movie about Benny Leonard called Fight for the Title. They used to call Leonard the ghetto wizard.
The great boxing movies haven't been about what happens in the ring. It's really the character that's created and what happens outside the ring that makes it work.
But there have been plenty of films to create drama in the ring as well as out. Cinematographer James Wong Howe, who photographed Body and Soul in the late 1940s, famously put a cameraman in the ring on roller skates with a small handheld camera to shoot the fight scenes in that film with a greater sense of intimacy.
You see things that don't happen in the ring in most movies about boxing. They're caricatures. They're over the top. I just accept it.
Body and Soul is considered one of the classics of the genre. Charlie Davis rises from the slums to live the good life of a champ, only to be asked to take a dive.
I still think I can knock that Marlow on his ear in two rounds.
Maybe you could, Charlie, but the smart money is against it.
He triumphs in the end by walking away from the gangsters who set him up. Clifford Odets' Golden Boy, which was made into a movie in the 40s, is about a musician who becomes a fighter.
I love the violin.
For all the obvious reasons.
But I've practiced for 10 years, and where am I?
In Somebody Up There Likes Me, from the 50s, Paul Newman does a star turn as Rocky Graziano. He has his ups and downs.
Can Rocky Graziano shake off every roof that is caved in on him?
And then he triumphs over his humble beginnings.
Somebody up there.
The Harder They Fall, 1956. Humphrey Bogart's last feature before his death is less uplifting.
Hey, the fight game in this country is falling apart.
A sports writer down on his luck is hired to be a press agent for a fighter. In this movie, it's the champ's handlers who are truly brutal.
I know you inside out, Nick. I know what you've done and how you did it.
In the end, the writer gives up his percentage of the take.
Nick, you're in trouble.
Then he sits down to write an exposé proposing the abolition of the sport. Nearly 50 years later, it's still an issue.
If somebody said it's going to be abolished tomorrow, and the 1,500 boxers who are now active will have to get another line of work, I couldn't complain. It is so corrupt and so brutal, and it's gone so long without taking any honest steps towards reform.
Yet it continues to inspire. It has been the background for fairy tales.
You believe that America is the land of opportunity. We picked you, Rocky. It's a chance of a lifetime.
But boxing films have more often told cautionary tales.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I haven't seen so many losers since my last fight at Madison Square Garden.
The fight movie is said to have come of age in 1980 with Raging Bull.
He is knocked out, and Jake LaMotta
with highly stylized, brutal fight scenes.
Has made one of the most remarkable comebacks in all boxing history.
And somehow both the fairy tales and the cautionary tales seem at least partially true, even now.
I think in the old days, from the body and soul set up, harder they fall era, the traditional organized crime gangsters ran boxing. Now the corruption has become corporatized. Now it's the casinos and Don King and the cable networks. It's a higher form of white-collar venality.
There are still fight movies to be made, says Jack Newfield.
There hasn't really been a kind of Godfather-level movie about contemporary boxing that shows the power of these huge corporations. Those are the banks of boxing now. They put up the money.
Until that movie is made, we have The Ring, The Champ, The Tip-Off, Winner Take All, Palooka, Golden Boy, Leather Gloves, Right Cross, Champ for a Day, The Square Jungle, The Prize Fighter, The Challenge, Split Decisions, Ali, and around 93 more. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Fishkin.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. My guest today is Robert Annecy, the author of The Gloves, and we're talking about boxing in culture. Sarah mentioned The Champ, the 1931 Wallace Beery, Jackie Cooper movie, which was the first art entertainment experience that I remember making me cry at age 7, sitting there alone in my house as the old man was fading. Not that it was a particularly good movie about boxing, I suppose. Do you have a favorite film about boxing?
Well, the interesting thing about boxing movies is how terrible most of them are. Two exceptions I can think of are
Rocky IV and
Raging Bull and Fat City, which is a John Huston movie from the early 70s starring Stacy Keach, which is one of the only boxing films out there that doesn't indulge in the sentimentality and schmaltz that Hollywood seems to lav all over the subject of boxing.
What makes – I mean, the Raging Bull obviously is not only widely acclaimed to be a great boxing movie, but one of the great American movies. What makes it so good as a boxing movie qua boxing movie?
A lot of things. One of them being that although the fight scenes are highly stylized, at times you can almost believe that you're watching boxers. And that's very important. I mean, most of the choreography in boxing films is ludicrous. And, you just have to take it on that level.
Ludicrous how, exactly? What can't happen that does in movies?
Well, the thing about hitting someone in the ring is that you're trying to conceal what you're doing until the last possible moment. And in a movie, you want to show what you're doing to make it obvious, to indicate the punch. So, these movie boxers are throwing punches that you wouldn't be able to hit, a house with.
One of my favorite films about boxing was the Rod Serling written movie Requiem for a Heavyweight 40 years ago, in which the star becomes a kind of WWF style freak show player at the end of the film. it sometimes feels today, what with the Mike Tysons of the world or this Fox show of celebrity boxing where Tonya Harding beats up, you know, a guy from Welcome Back, Kotter, that there is a sort of WWF-ification, a kind of carnivalization of boxing. Is that a depressing thing to you?
I think that carnivalization of boxing is as old as the sport, although in its modern form we owe it to Muhammad Ali, who actually attributes his carnivalesque style to Gorgeous George, the professional wrestler. He said he was on a radio show with Gorgeous George, and his jaw just dropped. He said, this guy really has an act. This guy can bring him in. I mean, as soon as that for me, that's just the fluff around the sport. I mean, as soon as you get into the ring, you still have to perform as a boxer. So no matter how much talk you talk outside of the ring, you have to show it on the inside. What's interesting in a film like Requiem for a Heavyweight, which I was just watching, is it's an unusual movie because it mixes the schmaltz with a dose of reality. I mean, I was listening to this monologue that Jack Palance gives in the movie, and it reminded me exactly of how one of the people I interviewed for my book, an old pro, talked about, you know, missing his shot at the title and still wanting it, you know, at the end of his career. And it was very chilling to watch it happening on the screen. And the professional wrestling thing that Palance ends up doing in the movie was based on an incident from the career of Joe Louis, the famous heavyweight who was broke and desperate at the end of, you know, toward the end of his life, and actually did put on the wrestling costume, which is, you know, one of the pathetic things about boxing. It doesn't take care of its champions or anyone. You know, fighters, when they're used up or just thrown away.
And I guess at this point, to kind of open the can of worms that boxing is politically, you start having a real debate about whether it should be abolished altogether in this country. And that may be one of the reasons that nobody wants to touch it.
Oddly enough, in the era we think of as a more primitive time, in the teens and the 20s and up until the 1930s, boxing was illegal in a lot of this country, and fights went on anyway, unregulated in back rooms. So if we want to bring that back, then we'll outlaw boxing. But you're not going to just get rid of boxing any more than you're going to get rid of prostitution by just saying it's illegal.
Robert Annecy, thank you for joining me today in Studio 360.
Well, thank you for having me up here.
Robert Annecy's book is called The Gloves, A Boxing Chronicle. For more information about him and about any of the stories you've heard on our program today, visit our website, studio360.org. The Hughes Brothers' terrific film From Hell has just come out on video and DVD. It's a retelling of the Jack the Ripper story, so of course it's grisly and scary, but not really all that bloody. In fact, the gruesomeness of the film is not so much visual as sonic. Steve Boedeker was a sound engineer on From Hell, and to close the show today, we asked him to demonstrate some of his scary sounds in his California studio.
This first one is, I just called it Opium Den, and it's just one of the elements that we used in some of these nightmares in From Hell. So, start this guy. As a sound designer, you can be a composer that has an unlimited palette of sounds to use in your compositions. And there's this sort of no man's land in between music and sound effects that you can do all kinds of things. So if you decide that at one point you need to have something be very intense and building and rhythmic, you can do that with anything. You can do that with a train building. You can do that with, like, low-end crashes that just build louder and louder and louder. Whatever you feel that you can sort of justify getting in there to help build that tension. Now, these are I called opium whooshes, which are just used for transitions to get in and out of other sounds. Here's another one that I did that talk about playing around. This is a recording of a bunch of little kids singing London Bridge is Falling Down that I slowed way down and then I processed and modulated. And definitely the idea wasn't to hear them singing London Bridges. I just thought it was kind of a funny little joke that it was made from little kids happily singing. But you put this in his dream and use little bits of it as sort of a texture. It's just strange and creepy. There's a couple scenes that take place in a morgue, and it's like, okay, how can we convey a feeling of just creepiness? It's not so much scary, just creepy. It's like, okay, we get this sort of low wind, and you just take some regular wind sounds and pitch them down and smooth them way out. And then stretch, stretch, stretch. And then add to that, like, some drips and things like that, you get this pretty wet place. Another thing I added was just simple recordings of flies, which to me says dead bodies. And it's like, yikes. You really are working to support what you see. You know, sound is a really powerful thing, but it's the marriage of the sound and the visual that really does it.
Steve Boedeker was the sound designer for the film From Hell, which has just been released on video and DVD. Our segment was produced by Jonathan Mitchell. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Jocelyn Gonzalez,
Steve Nelson,
Michelle Siegel,
Lital Mulad,
Andy Lancet,
Lou Olkowski,
Michael Rayfield,
Sarah Lilly.
The music is by David Van Tegum. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is a co-production of Public Radio International and WNYC New York, and is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Tiffany & Company Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
The psoriasis, like a fire smoldering in damp peat, will break out and spread triumphantly.
John Updike on his complicated relationship with his own flesh.
All of the writing I've done have been a kind of attempt to make up for the way my skin misbehaved.
Inspired by Skin. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.